Buddha, Siddhartha was the Sangha. People form ideals about just about everything. And in religion, people form ideals about how things should go in religion. And what happens when we form ideals is that inevitably those ideals are disappointed. Sometimes they're disappointed in rather hard ways. But unless our ideals are disappointed, we don't learn that they're delusory. It's actually a big part of a Zen master's job to, in one way or another, disappoint the ideals of the people who come to train with them. And that can be very hard for people to accept and understand when that's happening. Generally, that'll happen just by the master being himself or herself, unapologetically. Sometimes it has to happen in more deliberate ways. In an ideal world, people could impart, sincere people could embark on the difficult process of reharmonizing with the eternal, and all the difficulties would just be kind of predictable difficulties, and all the difficulties would be within the realm of what the individual thinks they can handle. In other words, they would all be ideal difficulties. But in the real world, there aren't ideal difficulties. They're the difficulties that you actually hit that are come about as the complex consequences of causes and conditions acting sometimes over lifetimes. When we hit these ideal, disappointing realities and difficulties, when we find out really how much faith we are really willing to muster and how much we really want to do what we're doing, how much we really want to walk the path. I want to read you a couple sections in Dogen that help explain this process. The first one is from Master's translation of Bendoa, or Lecture on Training. And Great Master Dogen says, "One who would train in Buddhism must first believe completely therein. And in order to do so, one must believe that one has already found the way, never having been lost, deluded, upside down, increasing, decreasing, or mistaken in the first place. One must train oneself thus, believing thus, in order to make the way clear. This is the ground for Buddhist study." One is tempted to interpret this lends credence to this interpretation. One would tend to interpret this is the attitude with which one must begin in some ideal beginning of training, and then it proceeds from there. But I'd like to suggest that this is an attitude one has to take all along in training. And that, so that when one encounters one of the great big messes, this is the attitude with which one has to find one through the way through the mess. And when one comes to the place of Sangha, this is the attitude with which one has to be willing to do Sangha and to proceed from the place of Sangha forward. So let me read that again and think about it in the light of what I've just said. One who would train in Buddhism must first believe completely therein. And in order to do so, one must believe that one has already found the way, never having been lost, deluded, upside down, increasing, decreasing, or mistaken in the first place. What could it mean to say something like that when one is having the consequences of mistakes rolling in? First, don't judge them as mistakes. Just accept the consequences of one's actions. The Sangha verse does not contain, you remember, the word mistake. Well, it does refer to wrong action. But let's just throw out the word wrong for a second and just think, if Sangha is saying, yes, I did this, yes, this happened, yes, these are the consequences of my actions. These are the consequences of my actions. If one can use the idea of mistake or the idea of wrong without the judgment, self-judgment in it, then it's okay. But especially for us Westerners, that hammer of self-judgment tends to come in so fast. We tend to introduce that into the thing so fast that we tend to turn it in a guilty direction. What this is saying, the passage I've just read from Bendoa is saying, you cannot go forward lugging a burden of guilt. You've got to drop the blame. Furthermore, you've got to drop what underlies the blame, which is the belief that there's something in the root of existence which is evil, and in something in you that is evil. Something in ourselves that is evil. And that is what he's saying. In order to walk the path of Buddhism truly, one must believe that one has already found the way, that one is in the path. Another way to say that, one is already saved, that one has the Buddha nature. Never having been lost, deluded, upside down, increasing, decreasing, or mistaken in the first place. Never having been in reality separated from the eternal. There are only just some clouds in a clear sky. When the clouds dissipate, there's the sun. So apply this in your mind to a messy situation. A messy situation. Situation involving misunderstandings, praise and blame, confusion, doubt, difficulty. Dogen's saying here, the way through this messy situation is to look up, not down. Believe in the fundamental goodness of the process you're going through, of the very process of suffering you're going through. Believe in its fundamental goodness. And instead of just looking for the magic wand that is going to eliminate the mess, walk forward through the mess. Her Master Mokugen, in her very practical very expressive way, talked about nosediving it. You know, plow right into the pain with an open heart. Instead of looking for the magic wand that removed the difficulty, then one will find the Buddha nature right within the mess and of all who are involved in the mess. Don't look for a devil that you have to get rid of and destroy. an evil enemy within yourself or in others. I'll read now a little passage from Uji. He says, since we learn, Reverend Master translated learn, she usually, when she talked, when she herself expressed this, she'd say we were brainwashed, basically. So think of learning here as a kind of brainwashing. Since we were brainwashed into believing that time and existence are not the truth, we think that the golden body of the Buddha is not ours, and we try to free ourselves from this very fact of being the golden body of the Buddha. And even in this dire strait, where we're so confused that we're trying to free ourselves from the golden body of the Buddha, we are still one with existence time, one with the flow of immaculacy, as also are those all those who are not yet enlightened. Take the mess and view it as the golden body of the Buddha. The more you try to free yourself from it, the bigger the mess becomes. Whereas if you just sit still and look up, the clouds, the difficulties begin to resolve, to dissipate. Sit still, look up, watch a truly perceptual path. Later in Uji, he puts it even more clearly. He says, that which is not good is not necessarily of no use, for all is existence, time, flow. All is the flow of immaculacy. If this were not so, there would be neither ocean nor mountain. Ocean and mountain here represent something. I'm not exactly sure what, But you could say, if this were not so, there would not be anything. Or if this were not so, we would never find the eternal. I'll read it again. That which is not good is not necessarily of no use, for all is existence, time, flow. If this were not so, there would be neither ocean nor mountain. The ocean and mountain are a reference to something. You got that somewhere. But it's somehow representing the eternal, the ocean and mountain, in our experience of the eternal. My interpretation here. But the key point is that which is not good is not necessarily of no use. The Reverend Master said so many times, God writes straight with crooked lines. That's the same, that's another way of saying the same thing. God writes straight with all the crooked lines. So, here's what we do. We get in a mess, and then we try to write straight. We try to straighten it out. And in so doing, as we thrash around in our driver's seedy way, we make the mess more, or we just substitute one mess for another mess. Or we put ourselves in a kind of straitjacket in our effort never to make the mess again. And then feel incredibly cramped and drive something inside ourselves desperate as it tries to free itself from the additional bonds it's in as a result of our misguided efforts to impose some kind of discipline on the mess. All we have to actually do is just get out of the driver's seat. Sit still, look up, let go and walk a truly perceptual path. The more time we spend trying to figure it out, trying to get it all worked out, the deeper we dig ourselves in. We already possess the Buddha nature. All beings already possess the Buddha nature. All situations are Buddha. No matter how messy, how painful, how horrific, they are all Buddha. So we have to treat them as Buddha. And how are we going to find how to treat it, the situation, as Buddha? We've got to go right in the middle of it and sit still and turn to the Eternal for help. And then we find the key for our own actions in this particular situation to treat it as Buddha. And when we do so, we will be walking the true path of the precepts, living the true spirit of the precepts. Here's another place in Uji where he says the same thing in other words. They travel fastest who are not there, since arrival is hindered by arrival, but quite definitely not hindered whilst on the journey. The journey is hindered by non-arrival, but not hindered by arrival. It is by means of the will that we understand the will. It is by means of words that we understand words. By being hindered, we understand hindrance. Listen to what he's saying. By being hindered, we understand hindrance. Okay, what is the thing we normally do here? I'm being hindered. I got to get rid of the hindrance. But Dogen's master told him, study in detail. Do not think it is easy. Do not look for a magic wand to remove the hindrance. By being hindered, we understand hindrance. Take the hindrance, take the mess, take the difficulty, bow to it, and learn from it. Take the particular form of spiritual pain, the particular physical difficulty, the particular difficulty with another person. Take that as the Buddha and learn from it. By being hindered, we understand hindrance. If it were not for the hindrance, we would not come to understand hindrance. See? Without the mess, there's nothing to be enlightened. Do you see what I'm saying? This is non-dualistic religion. If you're going to play this game, you've got to play by the actual rules of the game, not by some ideal. The harder we try to get rid of the hindrance, the more we burden ourselves with hindrance. By being hindered, we understand hindrance, and hindrance is hindered by hindrance. I don't know how she translated this. But think of it. Hindrance is actually hindered by hindrance. If you take it as Buddha and train with it, hindrance will actually convert and transform itself into an aspect of enlightenment, and thereby it hinders itself. The wound self-heals, is another way to put it, if you do the right thing spiritually. The wound will self-heal. Amazing translation. This would boggle your mind. But if you go at it from your heart, it makes sense. And over again, in the few passages I've read from Dogen here, he's saying the same thing in different words, over and over again. You've got to have real faith. You've got to have confidence in your own capacity to do this. And not just settle for second best because you simply don't believe in yourself enough to go into the midst of the mess and really look up and really let yourself feel that pain and see the causes of suffering. Now, this is for people who want to be real spiritual adults and who have real courage. It isn't for people who are so frightened of being wrong and of making mistakes or allowing another person to make a mistake that they tie themselves and others all in knots and try to walk a path of some kind of ultimate ideal safety. There is no such path. There is no spiritual life without great darkness. There is no enlightenment, genuine enlightenment, without going through a dark night of the soul. Dark night of the soul sounds like some poetic thing. You know, it's a phrase from Christianity, not Buddhism, actually. It's not some poetic thing. It's an unbelievable storm of pain. An unbelievable firestorm of pain that one hits one day. And you're given everything when you hit it that you need to get through it. And you find the Buddha right within it, not somewhere else. Kazan said, "Within the dragon's jaws I find many precious gems." Same thing. He also said, "Even though there should be a great fire, my heart is calm and still and filled with angels." Same thing. You can run from that darkness. That's one route. Or you can try to work out a strategy to obliterate it or contain it, compartmentalize it in such a way that you don't have to ever deal with it. That's another route. And those are the strategies of what Rivermaster called worldly religion. But if you want to walk the path of the perfection of Zen that she showed us, then you've got to go past the altar of worldly religion, as she did, and go into those dark mountains. One day, everyone who wants to go where she went spiritually has to walk that same route, their own version of it, but that same route. It's a complete delusion that there's another way, there's a way around it, an easier way. It's a complete delusion. There isn't. There isn't an easier way. All of the easier ways are much harder. This is the thing. This actually is the easy way. It's getting to the point where you really nosedive it. That's the hardest part. Once you nosedive and you're in it, the process just takes off. Then all you have to do is just do your meditation. Just keep looking up, and the process carries on of itself. This is how karma gets cleansed and converted, at the deepest level. The level beyond the level of just eons of meritorious action. You know, when one is ready to go beyond that point, that's where most religion stops, is just meritorious action, making merit. one is ready to go, when one is ready to go beyond that point, then one goes into those dark mountains where it seems impossible. And it only seems impossible. The seeming impossibility is, as the Christian mystics point out, is it's obscurity to intellect. The darkness is obscurity to intellect, not to the heart. Where intellect is convinced it is impossible, the heart rises up to meet the challenge with joy and confidence. It's only impossible to intellect and to being in to driver seatishness. That's what it's impossible to. It's not impossible to faith. It's not impossible to the Buddha nature. This is why the teachings on the deep teachings on reharmonization talk about the residual Buddha nature returning to oneness with the eternal, reharmonizing with the eternal. Because all the heavy lifting is actually done by your own Buddha nature. And what then is it that is you? You see, you are in that process, you are broken down into your constituent parts spiritually. So you're so blown apart spiritually that you don't even know what you are. And it doesn't matter, because that within you, which is of the eternal, is rising to its source and carrying everything along with it. This is one where one really learns about what no self means. There's no you in it. And this is why the burden of guilt has to be dropped. Because there's no one to be guilty. There's neither self nor other to blame. And when one tries to blame self or other, one's just clutching at shadows. One's trying to pin something on an unreality. What I'm describing is the way through every mess. Every mess and every difficulty. It's the way through it. Take it as Buddha. Look up, not down. Walk the path of confidence in the precepts, the true spirit of the precepts. The same as the path of confidence in your own Buddha nature. Why does he say in that first quote I read, one who would train in Buddhism must first believe completely therein. In order to do so, one must believe that one has already found the way, never having been lost, deluded, upside down, increasing, decreasing, or mistaken in the first place. Why is that so important? That's where you have seen that you pound yourself with the hammer of self-judgment and you say, I'm stopping. I'm not going to do that anymore. And that's where the precepts, what the precepts really are, come to life for you. What are the precepts really in their very essence about? They're about ceasing to treat yourself as evil. Ceasing to treat some part of yourself as evil. What does do not kill mean then? Don't keep trying to kill part of yourself. What does do not steal mean? I mean, don't keep trying to steal something from yourself. And so on with all the precepts. Do not be angry at yourself. Do not speak against yourself. Do not be proud and have part of yourself beating up on another part of yourself. Blaming another part of yourself. Do not criticize the three treasures. Every part of yourself is part of the three treasures. That's what he's talking about. That is the beginning of deeper spirituality. But that is so frightening to go to that point. If you actually were to go to that point, what would you have to hold on to anymore? What would you have to hold on to anymore? There isn't that familiar thing in yourself that you can always go back to kicking in order to prove that at least part of you is virtuous and worthy. There wouldn't be that familiar uncleanness that at least provides you some kind of reference for negotiating your way through life. That familiar delusion of uncleanness is what it really is. There wouldn't be that terrifying unknown of the immaculacy of nothingness. So we continue to live in our own shadow, pounding on ourselves and doubting ourselves because we prefer the devil we know to the devil we don't know. I'll read you the sentence that goes before the one I just reread for the third or fourth time. To truly study the way is to try to penetrate it. In order to do this, one must forget even the slightest trace of enlightenment. Then he talks about never thinking of oneself as being deluded. Both enlightenment and delusion have to go out the window. The fact that you cease to cling to some idea that some part of you is evil does not mean that you then substitute for that idea another idea that you are enlightened. Enlightenment and delusion are opposites. Let go of both. It doesn't matter whether one is deluded or enlightened. We don't have to sit in judgment about whether this part of us is good and this part is evil, this part is enlightened, this part is deluded, etc., etc. Let the opposites fall away, sit still, look up, and let the process that is trying to happen within us happen. Let it unfold. Instead of continually throttling down on it every time it gets hard and painful. And unfamiliar. Over the years, it's been interesting, both in this temple and at the Abbey, to watch it. See where it is that people actually run when they run. And what I've often noticed is that people often do their running not when they're in the most difficult and desperate state, but when they've just come out of that place to a more familiar and more normal place. But now they're looking down the road. They've had a glimpse of how difficult it could be. And now they're looking down the road and seeing, you know, I'm going to hit that again one day. I'm going to hit it big time. That was a taste of it, but there's something really big I'm going to hit one day. Now I've got out of this patch of it, I'm taking my winnings and going. I've seen that again and again. So many times I've seen people go through a really dark patch and really improve and then be gone. Very notably. Okay, so what is it that actually happens when a person does that? Well, think of it like you're baking bread, right? And we're talking about yeasted bread here, you know. You've done all the kneading and everything. You've got the yeast in it, and it's all worked up with its sugar and everything in it, so the yeast has something to feed on, and now it's been raised. And you've got it into the oven. That first really difficult patch is where it gets and hits that loaf, poor little loaf of bread gets into that really hot oven. And it hits that fire, hits the heat. Well, that's where it really does its, you know, if you know about baking bread, you usually put the bread in at an extra hot oven for the first, like 10 or 15 minutes, and then lower the heat a bit. This is the way I used to do it anyway. And when you do that, that does its final raising, and then it starts to form its crust in that heat. Then it has, that's just the beginning, it has a lot of cooking to do. So what is it the person does when they run, in this metaphor, after hitting the first really tough patch? They pull the bread out of the oven. Done now. And what happens then? Caves in, and and inside the bread there's an incredible sticky mess. Because it's not cooked yet. Only the surface of it started to cook. Inside it's a sticky mess. If you're going to do this, cook that sucker fully. Don't pull it out just because you've got a we've been through a rough patch and you've got a breather now. Keep it cooking. And don't worry about the fact that one day it's going to get far hotter, which it will. For those who have not hit that really big karmic storm of the really big karmic washing, it is one day going to get, you know, and you'll get through it. It's great. Once you're in it, it's great. It's the most wonderful transforming thing. You just feel like you're being taken to pieces. You don't know how you're going to be put back together. It's great. Just do not look for easy training. God writes straight with all the crooked lines. God writes straight with all the crooked lines.